Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room with the wood paneling, shag carpeting, the beanbag chairs, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. The ancient legends and myths of Native North Americans are as varied as the continent itself. Many of the legends deal with frightening ghosts, witches, demons, shapeshifters, monsters, and of course we can't forget about giants. I grew up hearing about some of the so-called mythical water creatures that inhabit Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, Lake Huron, and many of the deep, dark lakes of Ontario. And time permitting, we'll discuss some of those. Where do these legends originate? And why are there so many commonalities in the legends of the Native Americans and the myths and legends of other worlds, of the other great religions of the world? In the first 2 hours, investigative historian, avocational archaeologist, author Jason Jurrell joins me to discuss Native American myths, legends, and cosmology. Hours 3 and 4, well, of course, it's Friday. That means open lines. You scramble into the co-pilot's chair and help steer the mothership towards the second star to the right and clear on till morning. But first, what is quickly becoming another Friday tradition on Coast, it's time for the weekly Coast News Stories Update. Tim Banal is the news editor of the Coast to Coast AM website. You may know him as the host and creator of the pioneering paranormal podcast, Banal of America. He was a freelancer filling in for Lex and Sean on the website for many years, and now he covers the paranormal beat for us here at Coast, writing most of the original articles you see on the Coast to Coast AM website. Every Friday, he composes the In Coast You Missed It column and has a new feature to the start of our Friday night radio show. Tim is our guest with a roundup of some of the most fascinating stories from the last week. Hey, Tim, how are you, my friend?
Hey, Richard, good to talk to you again. It's been too long.
It has been too long. And, you know, we're both baseball nuts, you and I, so we have that in common.
Yeah, I got to keep tradition going because in October I said we were coming from the home of the world champion Boston Red Sox, but I have to update it now. We're coming here from the home of the world champion New England Patriots. It's been
the
plenty of riches here in New England.
It's good to win, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic.
I don't know what to make of this gentleman who wants to sue his parents for giving birth to him because they did it without his consent, apparently, Tim.
Yeah, this is one of the crazier stories I saw this week. It really made me laugh. As I joked in the article, he really took the childhood lamentation of I never asked to be born to a whole new level. Raphael Samuel, he is what he calls himself is an anti-natalist. He believes that people shouldn't be having children because it would help save the planet. And to sort of enforce that point, he's talking about suing his parents because his argument is they had him for their own pleasure and joy. He was not consulted in the matter, which is a really sort of existential question one asks. Like, how would they even do that? So it's a really weird, weird story. And I almost feel bad for him. He got a lot of publicity for it, but pretty much every news outlet I've seen covering it is having a good laugh at his expense. So,
well, as they should, quite frankly. I mean, the thing is, he gets on with his parents. He loves them. They love him, by all accounts.
Yeah, so weird. Yeah, well, I imagine the next family gathering is going to be rather interesting. Let's put it that way.
Yes, to say the least. All right, what's now just on the east coast of Canada and one of the Atlantic provinces, off the coast of one of our Atlantic provinces, we have the fabled Oak Island.
Yeah.
What's going on there with Oak Island and the treasure?
Well, I found this really interesting. This man named Robert Young, back in 1996, he was fortunate enough to be able to purchase a plot of land on the island, known as Lot 5, because they had divided it up into lots. And he went through the trouble of getting a treasure hunting license from the Canadian government and spent 10 years just scouring just his little patch of land on Oak Island. And while he never came up with the treasure, he found all kinds of interesting objects and artifacts just on his land there, including, this one was really interesting, a Spanish coin minted in Mexico that was never in circulation. It's from 1851, which predates the origin of the Oak Island treasure story.
Right.
It really raises the question of how did that coin end up on this tiny island? And, you know, maybe there really is something to this location that's, you know, special that we don't quite know about just yet.
Well, whatever it is, it just doesn't seem to give up its ultimate secret, Oak Island. Maybe we'll never know. I think the only person who's never been to Oak Island is me.
Oh, you've never been? I've been once. It's awesome. It's a great
place. You go. There you go. All right. Now, we often hear, and Tim, you post some of these stories on the Coast to Coast AM website. They're always fascinating. Both these mysterious creatures, they wash up on shore in Japan or some beach in the far-flung corners of the earth. But here we have a creature found in a New Zealand kitchen. Come on. What's going on there?
Yeah. Pretty much the last place, except maybe the bathroom, where you'd want to find a mystery creature is the kitchen. This guy, Tim Clark, he got a call from his mother. She found these on the floor of her kitchen. These are, it's hard to explain. It's in the number one spot on the carousel, so people can go and look at this video. They look like little sort of fuzzy bugs in this guy's hand. And the remarkable part, because it's in his hand, it's sort of a close-up. I think people are kind of fooled. They think they're like mice or something, but they clearly have to be tiny if they're in his hand. And no one can really figure this out. An Australian news outlet contacted all kinds of reputable institutions, University of Sydney, the Australian Museum, a biosecurity firm, and none of the experts could really agree on what it is. The general idea is maybe the detached legs of a moth that had been fallen victim to a household predator like a cat, or in one University of Auckland said it was a hoax. So it's really weird that no one can really put their finger on what these things are. So folks can check that out of the number one story in the carousel and see if they can figure it out.
Great job, Tim, and all of these stories again found up at coasttocoastam.com. Great pleasure speaking to you again. Go Sox, go Jays.
Nice talking to you, Richard. Have a great night.
All right, Tim. Investigative historian Jason Jarrell is next, discussing Native American myths and legends. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come warm yourself by the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Jason Jarrell is an author and public speaker whose interests include archaeology, anthropology, psychology, philosophy, Native American cosmology, comparative mythology, geopolitics, and the impact of consciousness-altering plants on human history and development. His research spans thousands of years of human history and covers ancient North America, Mesopotamia, and old Europe. His articles have appeared in Ancient American Magazine as well as on the Ancient Origins and AP Magazine websites. His first full book, Ages of Giants, was published in 2017. It relies on professionally documented evidence, including actual archaeological reports and textbooks, to recreate a cultural history of roughly 4,000 years, during which a powerfully built and exceptionally tall people existed among the indigenous populations of North America. Jason is currently working on a new book with co-researcher Sarah Farmer, which will explore the fascinating cosmology and ritual practices of the Adena and Hopewell Mound Builders of Eastern North America, and also definitely reveal the true identity of the Tall Ones. Jason Jarrell, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me and for giving me this opportunity to share ideas.
I believe since that bio was posted, Ages of the Giants, A Cultural History of the Tall Ones in Prehistoric America has come out. And now you're working on, is it your third book, correct?
Well, this is the second book. And the new book will trace the heritage of the mound builders across time to their living descendants, and then use the traditions of these people to interpret the older cultures and recreate the cosmos as these people saw it.
When we talk about Native American cosmology, I mean, it's not monolithic. I mean, because there are so many different Aboriginal nations or Native American nations that exist on this continent. But there are some commonalities, having said that, right? What are some of the common threads that exist in Native American cosmology throughout the continent?
Well, Native Americans of the eastern woodlands, the Great Lakes, and the plains, as well as elsewhere, have preserved a cosmological model which is tens of thousands of years old. This is the same cosmology that we see reflected in the symbolism and earthworks of the ancient mound-building cultures. It must go back to the original founding population of North America to be so widespread. The ancient and historic Native Americans viewed the cosmos as consisting of three interconnected worlds: the above or sky world, the earth disk, and an underworld. These realms are not considered separate, but rather as three connected layers of a single cosmos. The sky world and the underworld are not to be considered alternate dimensions or spiritual realms, but rather as parts of the same cosmos as the natural realm, which is directly perceptible by our senses. In other words, they're considered concrete realities. And each of the three worlds is inhabited by sentient beings of great power who are both spiritual and physical, as mankind is both spiritual and physical. The Algonquian-speaking peoples of the Great Lakes region refer to these beings as the Manitou, and ethnographers have come to understand that this term refers to intelligences who are other than human, who interact with mankind. And of course, it would be a mistake to define these beings as mere myths or symbols. As the great Ojibwa ethnographer Alfred Hallowell once put it, the spiritual entities of the cosmos represent a continuum with the ordinary world of sense perception. So, the three worlds and the beings who inhabit them are, to the Native Americans, ancient and in historic times, a very important present reality. The earth disk is the world of living humans, plants, and animals, which might be best described as the realm immediately detectable by the senses. The earth disk is considered a flat island floating upon and completely surrounded by a primordial sea. Above the earth disk, the sky world is the domain of the creator, usually known as Gichi Manitou or the Great Spirit, the stars, and the thunderbirds. The Great Spirit is the supreme power of the universe, omnipotent and omnipresent, the creator and ruler of all things. The Thunderbirds are usually described as gigantic bird-like beings who bring storms, rain, and lightning. And the oral traditions of many tribes also mention their ability to turn into human-like winged men, wielding great bows which fire lightning arrows. Prayers and sacrifices were made to the Thunderbirds, usually in exchange for good weather and success in hunting, but especially warfare.
Now, Jason, you mentioned that the Earth realm is, they called it a disk.
Yes.
So they believed that the Earth was flat. Was that sort of a common thread, whether we're talking about the Cherokee or the Ojibwa or the Algonquins or the Iroquois Indians or the Great Plains Indians? They all believed the Earth was flat?
That's correct. That's correct. In fact, ethnographers have remarked on this extensively. The ethnographer Alfred Irving Hallowell once made the following comment about this. He said, "The belief that the earth is flat is supported by daily observation and experience. No Indian, in fact, can be convinced that the earth is round. So even after European contact, the native people, at least in this part of the country, widely rejected the concept. that the Earth was round. The flat Earth disk is seen as sitting directly above the underworld, which is a watery abyss. It is inhabited by a race of serpent-like beings and other waterborne creatures. In the mythologies, there are gateways between the underworld and the Earth disk. They're located beneath certain rivers, streams, natural springs, and lakes. And it is through these underwater channels that the denizens of the underworld move in and out of the domain of mankind. There is a ruler of the watery underworld in Native American traditions, known as the Great Horned Serpent, who is alternately sometimes portrayed as a hybrid being with serpentine, feline, and other animal characteristics, referred to as the underwater panther. There are numerous permutations, of course, favoring these two basic forms, but archaeologists now understand that all forms are expressions or aspects of the same being, and the Ojibwa refer to him as Mishibishu.
Well, the idea of a horned serpent or a serpent, of course, that is something that's prevalent in the Judeo-Christian world as well. It might be interesting to sort of explore some of the parallels between the Judeo-Christian tradition and the Native American tradition. I mean, to what extent is the underworld in Native American cosmology parallel to, let's say, our concept of hell? And to what extent is the sky world in Native American cosmology parallel to our concept of heaven?
Well, the specific type of underworld that we see in the Native American cosmology in terms of a watery abyss or a watery underworld in which these beings exist, it isn't really a place of punishment like we see in the biblical concept of the lake of fire. But there is a different type of underworld that is inherent in the oldest Hebrew cosmologies, which can be compared with the concepts where we see in the Native American mythology. The above world, the Hebrew cosmology also divided the cosmos into three basic worlds. The above world in Hebrew cosmology is called Shamanim. The earth world is Erez, and the watery underworld is Tehom, a primordial sea. The primordial sea in Scripture is inhabited with serpent-like monsters who seek to destroy mankind. In fact, before creating the world as we know it, God first defeated and confined the sea dragons in Scripture. This is very similar to some of the Algonquian lore in North America, which tells of a great hero named Nanabozo who defeated the underworld monsters and banished them to the underworld before the creation of mankind. One name for the biblical great serpent is Rahab. In Job chapters 9 and 26, it is explained that God waged war against Rahab and his servants from the deep. In Isaiah chapter 51, Yahweh is said to have defeated Rahab and commanded power over the seas of the great deep. But probably the most popular name, well-known name for the underworld serpent in Hebrew cosmology is Leviathan, which in Hebrew is Lewayan. Leviathan is another adversary of God, described as a dragon or great serpent dwelling in the depths of the sea. And in Psalm 74, God is glorified for crushing the heads of the sea dragons and Leviathan. Leviathan is actually identical to another seven-headed sea beast found in the cuneiform tablets from Ras Shamra in Syria, known as Lotan, a great twisting or coiled serpent. So biblical scholars have long acknowledged that these ancient sea beasts and serpents in the Old Testament are actually what is intended by the symbolism in the book of Revelation.
All right, listen, let me jump in, Jason, and when we come back, let's delve into some of the great lake monsters and whether there is a correlation between those and the underworld of Native American cosmology. Hey, welcome back. Sitting in for George Norrie, coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. We'll get back to my conversation with investigative historian, avocational archaeologist Jason Jarrell in just a moment. I just wanted to keep you abreast of George Norrie's live events. Very, very busy man, to say the least. And he will be returning to the historic Everett Theater in Everett, Washington, Saturday, March the 23rd from 5 to 8 p.m. And he'll be bringing with him some amazing guests, including the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter Davenport, esoteric researcher, Johnny Enoch, afterlife expert and near-death experiencer, Daniel Brinkley, and an expert on mysticism, prophecy, and the occult, rogue scholar, John Hoag. Of course, there'll be a live band, audience participation, and a meet and greet to follow. And it's an event you do not want to miss. Again, that's Saturday, March 23rd, the historic Everett Theater in Everett, Washington. You can get your tickets online now. Just go to coasttocoastam.com, go to the events section, or you can call 425-258-6766. That's 425-258-6766. But we're not done yet. In May, Saturday, May the 11th to be exact, George is kicking it live in Columbus, Ohio at the Lincoln Theater. Again, that's Saturday, May 11th at 5 p.m. And you can join this grand experience with special guests, ghost whisperer Mary Ann Winkowski, certified hypnotist and paranormal mystery researcher Rosemary Ellen Guiley, the father of ufology Stanton Friedman. There'll be a special Mother's Day tribute, live band, audience participation, a meet and greet to immediately follow the show. Again, an event you don't want to miss. That is Saturday, May the 11th at 5 p.m. at the Lincoln Theater in Columbus, Ohio. You can get your tickets at www.capa.com, www.capa.com, or order online at ticketmaster.com. You can also call the CAPA Ticket Center at 614-469-0939, 614-469-0939, and of course, Ticketmaster, 1-800-745-3000, 1-800-745-3000. We're not done yet. Here is producer Tom with one more. Tom?
And the tour continues. Richard, how you doing?
I'm great.
We are going to hit the Miramar Cultural Center in the Miramar, Fort Lauderdale, and Miami area on Saturday, July 27th. We call it Radio to Stage, just like you were just talking about with the other shows. This particular show is going to be great. We're going to start off with psychic medium and spiritual counselor Chip Coffee. Then we're going to go to anomaly hunter Billy Carson, and he's going to show us evidence of past and present life on Earth, origins of technologies, some really interesting stuff. And then we're going to end the night with the motivational speaker, Jim Paris, and he'll talk about overcoming adversity, how to pray for a financial miracle, things like that in your life. There'll be a live band, audience participation, just like the other shows, meet and greet to follow. And what's really neat is we set up these microphones in the aisles so people can actually come down if they have one of the favorite guests they like and ask a question of them. So it's really interactive. If you want to go to this event, it's a beautiful theater. We just put it on sale. You can either go to the MiramarCulturalCenter.org or you can call 800-745-3000, 800-745-3000, or of course you can visit the box office in person. And all this, Richard, is on the Coast to Coast AM website if you need the info.
Fantastic. And George's first show down in South Florida, not to be missed. Thanks, Tom. All right, more on Native American cosmology when Coast to Coast AM returns right after this. And we are back with Jason Jarrell, investigative historian, avocational archaeologist, and the author of Ages of the Giants, A Cultural History of the Tall Ones in Prehistoric America. We're talking Native American cosmology, and you were talking about the great horned serpent, sometimes referred to as the panther, these denizens of the underworld, and the great horned serpent in particular sounds eerily familiar. Eerie, as in Lake Erie. We have the legend of Bessie, which is sort of very similar to the Loch Ness monster, Nessie. So we have Bessie in Lake Erie. We have Champy or Champ, a very similar sounding creature in Lake Champlain. And then, of course, out on the West Coast, we have Ogopogo. Are all of these legends associated with this underworld great horned serpent?
Well, I think that the first thing of importance with that question is to point out that the Native Americans themselves of the Great Lakes continue to the present day to describe encounters which they have with the underworld beings. Many of these encounters happen around Lake Huron. There's a village on Manitoulin Island in Lake Huron called Manitouwanig, which means den of the Manitou in Ojibwa. And according to Ojibwa tradition, there's a great pit or abyss at the bottom of the lake just off the local town pier that leads to the underworld. Several other lakes where the indigenous report encounters with the great serpents in this region are Whitefish Lake, Kwanja Lake, and several other areas. Perhaps the most remarkable aspect of modern encounters with the underworld powers is that the fact that Western non-native people with no knowledge of the local lore whatsoever have reported encounters. For example, in July of 1948, the passengers of a ship called the City of Detroit witnessed a creature described as a 60-foot-long water beast with scales and a gigantic horned head in the waters off of Georgian Bay. With regards to Lake Erie, Westerners have reported encounters with the great serpents in Lake Erie since at least the end of the 18th century. In 1793, the captain of the Felicity reported sighting a gigantic serpent in the Lake Erie Islands. And what's very interesting is that the southern Lake Erie shore and islands are the locations of numerous ancient burial mounds. In one particular, constructed around 2,000 years ago, a ritual smoking pipe featuring an effigy of the great serpent was found. This particular pipe is a ceremonial form which is believed to have been used by Hopewell shamans to channel spirit guides while smoking hallucinogenic tobacco. So it is entirely within the realm of possibility that the shaman who owned this pipe on Lake Erie was invoking the presence of Mishibishu.
Well, you know, we always learned about the various Great Lakes here in public school, and we learned that Lake Erie is the shallowest of the lakes. If there was a sort of an entrance or an entryway into the underworld beneath Lake Erie, wouldn't we have found it by now?
Well, all that we can really do if we look at ethnography and tradition the way that I do is simply report what's in the record. My job is to report Native American cosmology and tradition. I do find it very interesting, though, that many different people have reported encounters with cryptids and other types of entities at places that were also considered to be inhabited by similar creatures thousands of years ago. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there has to be an immediate connection.
According to the legend, what do these creatures, these underworld creatures, want? In the Judeo-Christian tradition, of course, we understand, you know, that the devil and demons are here to sort of corrupt the human soul and so forth. What do the creatures of the underworld in Native American cosmology want, if anything?
Well, they are fearsome beings and sources of imminent death and destruction. Mishibishu and his minions enter the realm of man through natural water sources, and they maliciously drown and kill human beings. For this reason, even in the historic period, Native Americans burned tobacco or made offerings before undertaking water voyages for protection. Mishibishu was also considered the lord and guardian of the Great Lakes copper supply in ancient and modern times. In fact, his horns, body, and tail are often described as being covered or laced in copper. There is a very interesting dichotomy, however, in the myths concerning these beings. For while they are regarded with fear and identified with great evil, they are also considered a potent source of magical power and knowledge of the healing arts. Mishavishu had dominion over water, game animals, and the fertility of plants, and could also offer offensive magical power. It's said that those brave enough to ally with him could bring death and destruction upon entire communities. So there is a dichotomy in the relationship with the underworld beings. They're incredibly dangerous, but they are also sources of great power. And there is an endless, relentless war between the thunderbirds of above and the underworld serpents, which is waged here on the Earth island or disk. The thunderbirds rain down lightning upon the underworld beings as they emerge from beneath the water. In many accounts, the thunderbirds assume the form of winged men wielding lightning bow and arrows, firing them at the great serpents. And according to Ojibwa tradition, if the thunderbirds did not wage war upon the serpents, they would overrun the earth and devour all of mankind.
So the thunderbirds are assigned to protect us, almost like guardian angels? Is that the idea?
Absolutely. This goes back to the beginning of time in Native American folklore and tradition. They tell us that before the creation of mankind, the great serpents actually ruled over the earth. And a great hero, known by several names, including Wasaka, Nanabush, and Nanabozo, emerged and waged a relentless war, driving the great serpents into the underworld and casting others into the stars. Then, following these events, it was he that assigned the thunderbirds to watch over mankind in the event that the great serpents would reemerge.
What's fascinating with the thunderbirds, because, as you say, that is a tradition within Native American cosmology that is very widespread, whether we're talking about the Great Plains Indians or we're talking about the Algonquins or the Ojibwa. It's so prevalent, but when did it start? Do we know?
Every shamanic society across the ancient world in the distant past possessed this cosmology of a tiered inhabited cosmos. And For untold millennia, it actually informed and shaped every manifestation of world religion, including Mesopotamian, ancient Greek, Roman, Japanese. It is also in the original cosmology of Judeo-Christian tradition, which could be why throughout the Old Testament, God himself, when he goes to war, is described as wielding the power of lightning and thunder, riding upon the wings of the winds. If you look around the world at mythology, you'll find it echoed everywhere. In the Hindu cosmology, the Garuda, depicted as a great bird or bird-like man, travels the earth battling the Naga, who are underworld serpents from beneath the earth disk. The Nagas are described as divine or semi-divine serpent deities who dwell in the Patala, the subterranean, watery underworld beneath the earth. So we can see the parallels of this cosmology as it gradually manifested in religion around the world. It must go back to the earliest belief system of mankind.
I had Andrew Collins on the program, I guess it was last month. He wrote a book called The Cygnus Key about the Denisovan legacy. And the constellation, Cygnus, which was very important to them, and this ancient civilization, which predates even the Sumerians and so forth, came out of, Siberia or Russia. And the Cygnus constellation is, the symbol is the swan. And I'm wondering if there is any connection between the swan and the Thunderbirds of North America, or some of the other myths that sort of depict birds and so forth.
Well, I can actually tell you that there's a particular archaeological site in northeastern Ohio where all those themes intersect. There's a 2,000-year-old burial mound that was excavated in the 1900s, which was found to cover a megalithic temple containing a large stone bird effigy with a wingspan of 32 feet and measuring 16 feet from head to tail. There were burials in both the north and south wings. This stone bird effigy has been interpreted by archaeologists as both a thunderbird who carried the souls of the dead to the Milky Way and the constellation Cygnus. At the feet of the two burials in the wing of the bird, the archaeologists discovered fragments of human skulls which had been smashed on a pedestal near the effigy. And there's an interesting correlation here with the Dark Rift and the star Deneb, which is the brightest star of Cygnus. The Native American traditions place a judge or opponent of the soul as the soul attempts to pass through on the death journey at this location. And in the traditions, those souls who failed to pass the test had their heads smashed open and the brains removed. So at this one ancient Hopewell Mound, we have connections to Cygnus, the Milky Way, and Native American lore and traditions.
Well, we're heading into a break here shortly, but let me just get sort of a short answer now, and we can expound upon that after the break. And that is, if the swan or the symbol of the Cygnus constellation is found here, and that is connected to the Denisovan civilization, is it possible that the Denisovans are sort of ground zero for a lot of the cosmology in North America and all over the world?
Well, I think that the cosmology that managed to find itself around the world in all of our ancestors, as far back as we've traced it thus far, is into the Paleolithic period. So if we're going to find an answer, an ultimate answer, in where its origin may be found, we would need to look at the symbolism of the earliest represented through art religions known to mankind. We would go back and look at Cro-Magnon, Neanderthals, and other peoples.
But is it possible that the Denisovans made it? And these were, by all accounts, these were giants, right? And we'll talk about giants more after the break. But is it possible these Denisovans or their ancestors crossed that great land bridge and came to North America?
Well, there's been Denisovan DNA found in Native Americans. We know that there's some type of connection. Whether or not they are the ultimate culprits for the culture and the cosmology, I think that the book's still open on that one.
All right, we'll pursue that when we come back.